Welcome back to Elder Sign, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Brandon Buddha.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. This episode, we are talking about Angel Language, AD 1618 by Alan Moore. This is chapter 8 of the novel Voice of the Fire. We're deep in Voice of the Fire at this point, but I will remind people nonetheless what this book is. It is a collection of loosely connected novellas and short stories that tell the story of Northampton, England over the course of 6,000 years. This is a book that Alan Moore originally published in 1996.
We're reading this because it's been nominated to us by a Patreon supporter, and then it was voted on by other supporters. So this is, a story of interest, a novel of interest in our broader listenership.
Yeah, every once in a while, these get on the ballot. They're all, you know, they've all been nominated. And every once in a while, they don't get voted for on the first go-round. And actually, I think that might even have been the case for this one. But they always do get voted for eventually. Let me say thank you so much for this nomination. I mean, it is just, I was thinking about this morning, Brandon. It's been years now since I've actually had to put something on a ballot myself. And I really appreciate that y'all are doing that work for me. That is only possible, of course, because of our Patreon supporters. And hey, if you aren't one of them yet, we would love for you to consider changing that status. There's tons of bonus episodes on Patreon. This month, we covered Wolf Alice by Angela Carter, which was a very interesting story. Angela Carter, we have covered before here on Elder Sign. I think she's really quite important to a lot of the new weird. She's certainly very important to Neil Gaiman, whom we have another show about on the network. So I've been really enjoying Angela Carter. And yeah, Wolf Alice on Patreon now, so you can go check that out. But let's talk about this story. This is a novella, so that means we are going to do two episodes. Next time will be the discussion. This is the recap. As far as getting us into this story, I think the thing I wanted to say here at the top, Brandon, is that it's an uncomfortable story. I mean, Alan Moore is frequently uncomfortable, but I think that's really dialed up here. So no specific content advisory, I guess, but more of a vague warning. And I think I'll leave it stand at that so we can just get into it, Brandon.
Angel Language AD 1618 is a first person account of the last days of His Worship Judge Augustus Nichols. Now, we don't get our narrator's name for a few pages in, not until we learn that his son, Francis, has spent some time with John Dee at Mortlake. And I wanted to reveal the narrator's identity up front so that those of you who may be intrigued, as I was, by the meeting of a Francis with John Dee at Mortlake won't get excited about this being a story about, I don't know, maybe an apocryphal afternoon that Francis Bacon was alleged to have spent with John Dee in the late 16th century, and that this story may also somehow be about cryptography or something. Let me just dispel that right up front and say that Judge August Nichols was a real figure. He did die in 1618 in Kendal, and well, now we can get into the way that Moore fills in the rest of these, I don't know, gaps of history, these questions surrounding the judge's death.
Well, you definitely can, Brandon, if you want. I mean, you definitely can go read, in fact, quite a bit about John Dee and his relationship with Bacon. It just will be the much more interesting medieval figure of Roger Bacon rather than Francis Bacon.
It's also
going to be mostly about John Dee reading books, right? That's what it's going to be. I do have actual specific recommendations for this as well, which I will give to people in the discussion episode. But really, I'm interrupting the flow of the recap here so that I can do some of the orienting that I like to do at the beginning of these episodes for Voice of the Fire. Though in this case, I don't think I need to do very much because we are only 10 years on from Confessions of a Mask, the previous story, which we just released. So I think that is all probably fresh in people's minds. But nonetheless, I will remind people that we are in the period known as early modernity. And in terms of English history, we are deep in the reign of King James. And in fact, the King James Bible has been published in between these two stories. Also, Shakespeare just died in 1616. On that note, you know, thinking about 1616 here, I should say that Moore does actually have the date of this story wrong. Judge Nichols did not die in 1618. He also died in 1616, which is to say the same year as Shakespeare. And it seems to me that there's a story there, right? But it is not the story that Moore wrote. And just a little preview here, you know, why did Moore write this story and not a different story has come up twice already. You've brought it up. I've brought it up. We're only on the first page of the story. We're like in the first paragraph of the story. So I think we can guarantee that that is going to be a topic in the discussion. At any rate, Judge Nichols died 1616. His tomb is now in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, the V&A Museum, it's, you know, called. This is a place everyone should visit. I mean, the museum, not specifically the tomb, although it is actually really beautiful and cool to look at. The tomb has been there for a long time, though. Like, and it's not a recent move. So I don't have any hypothesis about the genesis of this story. I mean, I have some thoughts about that, I guess, but I'll save that for the discussion. What I'm really just trying to say is that I don't think that the genesis of this story involves Alan Moore walking around Northamptonshire and, you know, seeing something, you know, a building and reading an interesting plaque in a building or wandering into some kind of exhibit about something, which has been my hypothesis for the genesis of the last several stories. Something different has to be happening here.
I think so. I also want to point out Francis Nichols is Augustus Nichols' nephew, not his son, though he is his heir. And I wonder, you know, I just wonder where exactly Moore is getting all of his info from, or if he's kind of relying more on, I don't know, a kind of maybe oral tradition of local history or something like that. I don't know where he's doing his research, but it is something I am really desperate to ask him if I ever meet him. Where did you do your research for Voice of the Fire?
Yeah, and this story in particular, because of the things that, you know, we've been pointing out, this is a real question for me. And definitely I have a whole segment on the outline for the discussion episode about Francis Nichols and what Moore has done with that character and how that does not at all line up with the actual historical character of Francis Nichols. And then wondering, of course, why Moore made these choices. But all of that is for the next episode. So I will stop jabbering about that now and let you get on with, hey, what's actually happening in this story?
Well, we meet Judge Nichols as he is riding in a carriage en route to Kendal with a widowed woman and her daughter. Now, the woman is referred to as the Widow Dean, and the young girl's name is Eleanor or Nellie. And I can maybe save you, our listeners, about 80% of the word count of this story up front by saying simply that Nichols thinks about having sex in general, and naked women. He thinks about these things pretty much constantly, and since he's sharing a carriage with a woman and her child, he's really trying to arrange a situation where he can have sex with the widow while he's staying in Kendal. Nichols, I'll mention here too, is indiscriminate with regard to the age of women he'd like to have sex with, so long as they are young or youthful. And he knows that he can use his powerful position to persuade women who are down on their luck to sometimes have sex with their daughters as well. And this is a real intruding thought for Nichols throughout the story, how he might get to have sex with Eleanor too. In any event, the widow brings up that it may be improper for someone of the judge's status to be seen with such a woman as she is, especially as she's new to town and has moved here for work. And that makes sense. But Nellie or Eleanor suggests that they should have the judge for dinner the next evening. And that works out for everyone because the judge is going to have to pass sentence on some criminals after visiting the jail. And it's best to pass sentences when all of your appetites are sated so that you can be sure of your clear and fair judgment. Now, there's one more detail in the story here that is worth pointing out during the carriage ride that invites us into the judge's consciousness, which is this. While riding in the carriage and thinking about sex, the judge does see, quote, a great black farm dog trying to match stride with the carriage. Later on, the judge thinks maybe it is a horse, like later on, I mean, within the next couple moments. But, you know, though this is a curious sight, something strange to see on the road, there's nothing here to worry about, I promise.
Right. Yeah, I didn't care for this story very much. And it is because, as you say, Brandon, it is 80% lewd thoughts. And it's really a lot of Alan Moore showing off his knowledge of bawdy Shakespearean sexual terms. So I am very grateful that you have dispensed with all of that. And we can just take it as given. And we don't need to spend 80% of our episode on that. But I have to say, again, I find this a strange choice. And to be clear, it is a choice. It's a choice that Moore has made. This is an invention of his. You can track down every contemporary source that we have for Judge Nichols by starting with the 19th century Dictionary of National Biography. And I did track down all of it and read all of it, something I did for kicks. None of them say anything about lewd behavior or any kind of scandal like this. And in fact, if anything, Judge Nichols was puritanical and was best remembered for being rabidly anti-Catholic, which is how he received such favor from King James. One more thing that I want to note here before we continue is that this is another story where the action does not take place in Northamptonshire. Kendal is a village in the Lake District. It's quite some distance from Northamptonshire, really, and I was surprised that someplace so far away would be in Judge Nichols's circuit, but actually it turns out it was, though there is actually still some scholarly work that has to be done there where some people have argued that the fact that he was in Kendal indicates that he'd actually taken a different post, but that it just hasn't, we don't have any surviving administrative documents that show that sort of thing. But at any rate, this is actually just a part of his circuit, even though it is significantly far away from Northamptonshire. And I found that interesting as well. And I thought probably other people are having the same thought that I'm having here, which is that these two places are really far apart from each other, but everything is on the up and up here as far as Moore writing this story.
I want to actually just return to the text real quick. I mentioned this black farm dog motif, this black dog. We'll talk about that in the discussion episode. There is another motif that I noticed a little more clearly as I reread the story, which is this vision of this girl in the sunset, this kind of waif or ghostly image. That comes up a lot. It comes up when the judge meets Nellie. I guess I just want to put that out here. It has to do with the Francis Nichols story that we'll get to as well shortly. But let's return now to the flow of narrative as Moore has presented it to us. So Eleanor and the widow Dean just get off the carriage, and they're met by a dull-looking girl, and then the judge travels on to his rooms in the town of Kendal. Now, interspersed with much of this business about the traveling and the judge's duties is the judge's reflections on what happened to his son Francis during the time when Francis studied or stayed with John Dee. And I'll get to all of that in a moment, because that stuff feels shoehorned into me here a little bit as a flashback. And I'd rather get through the present of the story, through the conflict of the plot, and then we can handle the angel language stuff in one fell swoop. I don't know. Perhaps we'll discuss the value of homonymic names in our discussion as well. The last names, Dean. We'll see Deary come up soon. But in any event, the next day, the judge visits the jail to learn about the man he will likely have to sentence to death due to the evidence presented against him. Now, as I just said, the man's name is Deary. He has stolen some livestock and has sold off some of the stolen property, the livestock, and he salted the rest of it to preserve. He doesn't seem too worried about anything, though. He doesn't seem worried about being sentenced to death. He's not worried about the evidence against him. And there's really nothing the judge can do about that. So he leaves the jail and waits until it is time to walk to the Dean cottage about a mile outside of the town where, I don't know, maybe he's going to get to have some sex with multiple women. The judge is a little worried as he walks to the cottage about whether he'll be able to find it, but also about that black dog that was maybe a horse that seemed to keep pace with the carriage. He's about to turn back due to his worries when he sees a light beaming through a window and realizes that he's finally arrived at his destination. He knocks on the door and is invited in, and everyone in the house, the mother, a grandmotherly figure, an older woman, the widow Dean and her daughter, and then that doll looking girl that he saw from the carriage. All these women either treat him with contempt or flirt with him, and sometimes do this in turn, one after the other. He eats a terrific meal. The meal that was made for him is tremendous, and he thinks about how being poor can be a real burden. But he eats too much, as it turns out, and suddenly he feels paralyzed with how peppery and fiery the beef was. But wait, he is actually paralyzed. And now the women are all talking about getting undressed. So he's pretty confused. I think anybody would be in this situation. The women are being told to wait, to hold off by the eldest of the women, who the judge now thinks might be up to something. And they are up to something. The cottage is actually owned by the Dearies. And I guess if the judge is dead, maybe the livestock thief won't be able to be sentenced. I don't know if this is explicit in the text. Also, the widow is the daughter-in-law of the old crone in charge of the cottage. And she's been brought back into the fold after the imprisonment of her husband. So she's been brought back into this family so long as Eleanor is initiated into the family practice of killing and carving up people to eat, I guess. I don't know. The judge dies here. Anyway, this is where the present day narrative ends, but we still have to briefly cover the flashbacks involving Francis.
Yeah, this climactic scene here, this is harrowing. It's really actually pretty scary. Even though the sex stuff in the story was not suited to my taste, I do really want to applaud Moore's technical skill with this scene. I have a lot of questions about what's going on here, including whether there is indeed about to be some cannibalism. We're going to take those up in the discussion episode for sure. But before we leave this scene behind, I do want to point out a few things. One, it is super hot in this cottage. The judge is uncomfortable and starts sweating and feels like he's going to pass out. And in the real world, you know, not in the world of this story, the judge died of what is called ague, which just means a fever. And I like how Moore has interpreted that here, right? He's giving us all the symptoms of a fever, but it's really something else is going on. And the other thing I want to say here is that these women feel straight out of Macbeth, and the judge himself even thinks as much, or at least thinks something that, you know, makes the illusion for us. Here's what Moore writes. Without their clothes, they seem not human, but more like some cadre of weird sisters, fates or gorgons stepped from legend. And I really appreciated that as well. Look, if you can, you know, if you can make an allusion to Macbeth in your story, I'm going to like it a lot more, you know, no matter what else is going on, even if it's 80% lewdness that I don't care for. You bring some Macbeth in and I'm into it.
Yeah, it is a great reference. Yeah, another potential cause of death attributed, I guess, to Nichols here was also surfeit, which is, you know, I guess the excess consumption of something like food. So Moore does have some kind of source that is referencing these two potential causes of death for Judge Nichols. He's using them really well, but as far as I know, Nichols was never carved up or his body done away with. So yeah, there's a strange play with history here. And I wonder if Moore is asking us to fill in the blanks to say, okay, we know that his body wasn't found carved up or whatever, that he died of fever or having eaten too much food. And what is really going on? I cannot wait to get to that question because I don't have an answer right now. So we have some time to think about it before the discussion episode. Let's return to this flashback involving Francis Nichols now. So as I mentioned, interspersed throughout all this plot, and I guess to add an extra layer of intrigue to the story, there are some details about the judge's son, Francis, and his relationship to John Dee. And basically what happened is this. Some years ago, Francis took up with John Dee and Edward Kelly, who was Dee's scryer. I think we'll talk more about all this stuff in our discussion episode. But apart from Kelly's scrying and Dee's writing down the syllables Kelly has received from the angels, these men also wanted to live in a kind of open, free-for-all, like wife-swapping situation. And we're testing the waters to see if Francis wanted to join them, to get in on this action. And this really bothered Francis quite a lot, as did Francis's witnessing of an apparition of a little girl he saw. And he wonders, you know, is this an angel, a demon? And he saw this little girl one evening as twilight fell upon Dee's house in Mortlake. Like I said, this is, image is a motif throughout the story, maybe a portent of some kind. Eventually, Kelly left Dee's employ and was replaced by an acknowledged fraud named Bartholomew Hickman. And Dee fell out of favor with the regency as Queen Elizabeth was replaced by King James. So we don't need to worry about Dee anymore. But Francis was altered by his interactions with these scientists and mystics. And the judge is of two minds about all this, because there's no denying that Dee was brilliant, but his metaphysical project was suspect and maybe a little bit of a catastrophe. To the judge's mind, though, this angel language that Dee copied down was truly incoherent and of no use or value. And I guess he wished that his son had just stayed out of it. And I don't know, maybe that just about sums up this aspect of the story. And so I'll say here now that that is, I don't know, a jumbled retelling of Moore's angel language.
Yeah, we're going to have to do a lot of unpacking of this in the discussion. I mean, for one, the title of the story promises us angel language, but we never really get it. And the story isn't about John Dee at all. It's just this flashback that, you know, you excised from the story. That's not really how it's presented, but I don't know any other way that we would go about telling, you know, explaining this story to people who haven't read it, right? Other than to set that aside. And I think that tells us something about what it's really doing in the story, which again, we will take up in the discussion, because the connection between the main action and the flashback is just that the judge sees a little girl silhouetted with the sunlight behind her. And it reminds him of this experience that his son had at Mortlake, not his own experience. It reminds him of a story someone else told him, right? That's the connection here. So yeah, I have questions about this. We will take them up in the discussion episode. And I guess I'll preview the discussion episode as well by saying that even though John Dee does not appear in this story very much, that is mostly what the discussion episode is going to be about. And on that note, that is going to do it for this episode. It's, you know, a short recap for such a long story, but we have a lot that we're going to do in the discussion episode. So yeah, that's it for this one. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brandon Buda. And as I said, yes, the recap was short, but I cut out a lot of the lewdness and maybe some of the character of the story as well, and maybe a whole other layer that we didn't talk about that we will talk about in our discussion episode. But you'll have to wait to hear that, and you can find us and all our other shows at claytemplemedia.com.
Let me say thank you once again to the Patreon supporter who nominated this story, even though I think we have said all over this episode that there was way too much bawdiness for our personal taste. Still, I'm very interested, generally speaking, in the voice of the fire and specifically in this story. And I'm actually really quite eager to get to that discussion episode. So yeah, let me say a huge thanks to that Patreon supporter. And if you are not a Patreon supporter, we would love for you to become one. And if you do, you will be just in time to get our brand new episode about Wolf Alice by Angela Carter. Next time here, we will be back with the discussion episode for Angel Language. And until then, we greet you and say farewell.